left off. But since it's been almost 2 weeks, I'll just simply mention this in passing. I've seen it lots of times. It's just a reminder that in the last days, the Lord has made it possible for us to understand a lot of things in Scripture that I don't think any other generation, other than this last generation, was really meant to understand. And I pointed out that the Revelation, first two words in it, apocalyptus, are the words that mean to uncover and to unveil. And that's what's been happening as man's knowledge has increased. We've uncovered, we've unveiled a lot of knowledge. I talked about the first earthquake in the book of Revelation, in Revelation 6:14 and 6:12. In 6:12, that's the first earthquake in the book of Revelation. I talked about how all the earthquakes, all the fire and brimstone occur between the first earthquake in Revelation 6:12 and the last earthquake on the last vial poured out in Revelation 16:18. And I've talked a great deal about the way that God put the earth together, how that everywhere you see a red line on that chart, it goes all the way down through the earth and it eventually makes contact with these great underground liquid lakes of rock called magma. Now, how all these pieces of the earth crust float on these underground liquid lakes of rock called magma. And I pointed one out in particular that goes all the way down the middle of the Atlantic Ridge, all the way around the southern tip of Africa through the Indian Ocean to the Gulf of Aden and right on up to Israel. It's this crack right here that you see going down the middle of the Atlantic. I pointed out how it went on up the Red Sea into the nation of Israel. I pointed out this section to right here is spreading rapidly. This section is fused together like modeling clay. Two diametrically opposing forces, both generated by God. In the past, God fused this together, pushed it together as these plates floated together and they locked. Then he began to spread this apart down here. They're diametrically opposed and tremendous pressure is building up in the Gulf of Aqaba. Sooner or later, that's going to rip from one end to the other. The Bible indicates it'll rip for 1,600 furlongs or 185 miles. Then have a lot of earthquake activity in the area of the Gulf of Aqaba, which you see right here. And recently, we started to have quite a bit up in the valley that runs from Haifa all the way down the plain of Es Elon and down the plain of Jezreel. Sooner or later, when the critical spreading pressure is reached right here, this is going to rip open. I've been talking about a lot of things that would happen. The last thing I talked about was how this section of the Jordan River Valley from right here to right here would rip open. I pointed out that the Bible indicates it will rip open for 1,600 furlongs, 185 miles. That's from right here to right here. I indicated how this would generate a raging flood basalt plain, how the liquid rock would come up on both sides of the valley and fill the valley to a depth of 5 feet. So I've talked an awful lot about these plates, and everything I've said I covered in intricate detail. And so what else is God going to use these for? Well, the immediate thing he's going to use them for is to destroy the Antichrist army. Now, the Antichrist army is going to be the most formidable that was ever assembled on this earth. And they're not going to be destroyed by atomic weaponry, and they're not going to be destroyed by a lot of conventional weaponry, although people will die because of conventional weaponry. But these plates are going to be used to destroy the Antichrist and 5/6 of his army, according to Ezekiel chapter 38, verses 1 and 2. We're going to take a look at the reaping of the evil vine of the earth. Now, the evil vine of the earth consists of all the followers of Antichrist. And there'll be a tremendous army, millions upon millions of millions, as the Bible describes it. They'll be gathered down the plain of Es Elon, down the plain of Jezreel, where all these earthquakes will be occurring. They'll be down the Jordan River Valley, all the way down that 185 miles or 1,600 furlongs of a raging flood basalt plain. And God's going to destroy the Antichrist by his own power. In Daniel 11:44-45, he says, But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. I've already covered that in the past here many times. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly make away many. He goes back to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, goes back from his headquarters in Cairo, Egypt, goes back across and positions himself and puts the tents of his mighty army between the Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea and the glorious holy mountain we know as Mount Moriah, where the temple was located in the days of Solomon and in the days of Zerubbabel, in the days of Herod, and as it is now located, non-existent, but would be north of the Dome of the Rock on the Temple Mount if it were still in existence. He's going to come back and camp out on the Temple Mount. The tents of his army, perhaps the tabernacles, the word is ohel, tabernacle means tents, the tents of his mighty army. The word palace is an apodyn, it means his military fortress headquarters. When he does that with these armies, millions upon millions of men, which he commands, then something is said about him that's difficult to understand. He's come back to wipe out Israel, to destroy them in the Negev, to utterly make away many. Only he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. And as I pointed out many times, the reason no one can help him is because God is about to have payback time. He is about to destroy 5/6 of the Antichrist army, according to Ezekiel 39:2. He is about to create the most furious and horrific transformation of the land that's ever occurred in Israel. And the Antichrist and his army are going to get caught in the middle of this fire, brimstone, and hell from beneath, and earthquake from below. 5/6 of his army will be destroyed. And he gathered them together in a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon, Revelation 6:6. This is where the army of millions upon millions are gathered. They're blanketing all of northern Israel. They're all under the Antichrist's command. They're from every nation in Europe and in Africa, in Eurasia, in Asia, in the Middle East, from China. They're from everywhere. And they've come there, and they are under his command, and he has gathered them there, and they are finally ready to destroy Israel completely. But notice what he says in Ezekiel 39:2 and 3. And I, God says, I will turn thee back and leave but the sixth part of thee. And I will, not man. I will cause thee to come up from the north part. He will come from the north against Israel. With 1,260 days left in the tribulation period, he will launch a surprise attack. He will overrun the city of Jerusalem. He will take all of northern Israel, and he will drive Israel into the southern part of Israel, which is the land from Beersheba down to Elot, which is over one-third the total land mass of Israel, and will bring thee up thee upon the mountains of Israel. He's going to bring them up to the mountains of the southern Negev, and I will smite thy bow out of thy left hand and will cause thine arrows to fall out of thy right hand. Now, this is going to be the most horrendous thing that's ever happened. And this is what's going to happen to destroy the Antichrist and his army, and this is why no one can help him. Revelation 14:17-19. Another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven, he also having a sharp sickle. Another angel came out from the altar, which had power over fire, and cried with a loud cry to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in thy sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, the vine of the earth, the army of the Antichrist, this multiplicity army, for her grapes are fully ripe. She has truly come to the epitome, the zenith of evil and moral decadence. And the angel thrust his sickle into the earth, and gathered the vine of the earth, and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. Winepress, the word is used, is lenos. It means a rectangular trough cut out in the rock of the earth. They would, in all vineyards, they had them, and once the grapes were harvested, they would cut out a rectangle longer than it was wide, a rectangular trough in the earth. They'd chisel it out of the earth. They'd make the top end of it maybe about a foot, foot and a half, maybe 2 feet deep. Then they'd make the far southern end of it actually deeper, probably about 3 feet. Then they would get in the northern part of it and they would stomp on the grapes. They'd stomp all the juice out and it would flow down to the southern part. There they would put it into leather bags, and they would take those leather bags, pouches that they had made that were waterproof, animal skin, and they would lower them down into a cool well, and it would ferment naturally into wine, not this muscatel stuff that's got a kick to it that'll knock you on your tail. But you'd have to drink an awful lot of this wine, naturally fermented, to get drunk. At the Hebrew meals, they actually mixed it at a ratio of 1 to 10, so it would be impossible to get drunk on it. And they did that because the grape juice was quite good, and also because it tended to purify the water. So let's take a look at this, and we're going to take a look at a Hebrew wine press, because all wine presses and vineyards were rectangular troughs in the rock of the earth. They made them rectangular because you needed to stomp the grapes in one end. You need to have it slanting down toward the other end so the juice would flow down there so they could collect it in the animal skin. Matthew 21:33. Hear another parable. There was a certain householder which planted a vineyard and hedged it round about and digged the wine press in it. The word dig doesn't mean he dug it out of the earth, because it goes without saying, if he were to dig a wine press just in the dirt, when you started trying to crush the grapes, all of the juice would go down into the ground. So when it says dig the wine press, it means he chiseled it out of the rock and built a tower and let it out to husband and went into a far country. This is a typical vineyard at the time that the writings concerning vineyards existed. And if they found a particularly fertile plot of land, they would build a fence all the way around it to protect it from the Midianites, the Hittites, the Perusites, the Jebusites, the Termites, and whatever kind of ites were around there. And they put these watchtowers so that if they saw the Midianites or someone coming to steal away their grapes and their grape juice and the harvest, they would sound an alarm and they could raise the people from the city. So out here in these vineyards, this is where they would put the wine presses. They usually dug them in Turonian limestone, if there was any Turonian limestone there. Otherwise, they had to dig them in what you call Cenomanian limestone, which was much harder. This is a rectangular trough in the rock of the earth that they had dug out in the past. You can still see the vegetation in it. It hasn't been used in centuries. At one time, this here was, in this particular one, they had the juice draining off into here, and this was a rectangular trough. Then they drained the juice off into here, and then they would put it in the animal skins and put it down wells. Here another parable. There was a certain householder which planted a vineyard and hedged it round about and digged a wine press in it. This is the God-breathed word, lenos, and built a tower and let it out to husband and went into a far country. I want to establish without question that that's exactly what the word wine press means and what it was like. A Greek and English lexicon of the New Testament by Dr. Edward Robinson, 1850. The trough for drinking water, a wine trough, the lower vat or trough dug in the rock or earth. Comprehensive Lexicon of the Greek Language by John Pickering, 1853. A ditch, a canal, a pool, a watering place. A Greek-English lexicon based on the work of Francis LaSalle by Lydell and Scott. Anything shaped like a tub, trough, or chest. So in essence, it was a rectangular trough chiseled out of the rock of the earth. And they would get in it and stomp the grapes. This was one in the city. This is the way they looked out in the vineyard. And this is what John is talking about when in his vision he looks down from earth and he sees this great wine press filled with blood. So let's take a look at this, and let's go this line by line, verse by verse. The great lenos, the great wine press outside Jerusalem. Now when that valley rips open, it's going to rip open, and from the air, looking down on it, what would appear as a rectangular trough in the rock of the earth. If you want to know what the Jordan River Valley is, it is a rectangular trough in the rock of the earth. If you fly over it and look down at it from above, you'll see two steep bluffs on both sides of it. That's where the two fault lines are, one on this side, one on this side. And you'll see a flat valley plain, and it is a rectangular trough in the rock of the earth. Now bear in mind that God is giving John a vision, and John is seeing all this in the future, and he's looking down on Israel. Now he recognizes Israel. He recognizes the Jordan Valley. He's looking at what's happening there, and he's trying to describe it in terms that the people of his day would understand. And if we're going to understand it, we're going to have to know what a vineyard looked like, and we're going to have to understand the imagery that's used, or we won't interpret this correctly. And another angel came out from the altar. There are a whole series of angels that keep coming out. It's Revelation 14:18-20, which had power over fire. This is very important. Now, people in heaven don't just sit around doing nothing. That's fact. They just don't sit around doing nothing. And angels sure don't sit around doing nothing. You know, there is a part of our character that we got from the Lord. It's a part of our natural makeup. And even though we're sinful and depraved, we still have this characteristic. God is a creator. And apparently he loves to create. He loves to make things. He loves to form things. He loves to change things. And we inherited his nature to the extent that we're not happy unless we feel like we're accomplishing something, whether it's growing a garden, growing flowers, mowing the lawn, a whole multitude of things. We're just not happy unless we're doing something. Even it involves using your mind and working on your income tax or something. You're just not happy just to sit around and do nothing. And so God gives authority to angels. They have jobs. And when God gives authority to someone, God isn't like us. I'm thankful for that. If I were to give somebody a job, and they just kept goofing it up and goofing it up and goofing it up, I might not chew them out for it. Probably wouldn't say anything to it. But I'd just do it myself. But the Lord isn't like that at all. And when he gives an angel authority, power over something, he doesn't override him or bypass him. He uses him to do the task that he assigned him. Now, he has given this angel the right, the authority, to decide when fire is going to be used. So whatever is going to happen involves fire. And cried with a loud voice to him that had the sharp sickle. Now there's another angel that had come out before him that had a sharp sickle. Now this angel with a sharp sickle, he's got a job to do. But the angel that has power over fire is the one that he must get the right, the authority, get his approval, get him to say, yes, release it. So this is a system that God has where everybody's doing something. Say, now the angel with power over fire says to the angel that came out before him, thrust in thy sharp sickle, shoot, into the earth, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. This is an expression that has to do with iniquity, sin, evil, coming to its fullness, to where it's reached the zenith, and God is about to pass judgment. Just like grapes that are fully ripe, you don't want to leave them on the vine. Get them off the vine if you want the juice out of them. And the time has come for God's judgment. Now, once this angel with power over fire gives him the okay, and the angel thrusts his sickle into the earth, that's the word ace. It means shoot down into the earth. And you'll see why I'm emphasizing that later on. And gather the vine of the earth and cast it into the great lanos, the great rectangular trough in the rock of the earth. That's where the sickle went down. Shoot! It went down into the earth and it released fire from the earth because this angel had power over fire. That's the only reason this is specifically mentioned that he did. The great winepress of the wrath of God. Now, we are, at this particular point of time, coming up to the wrath of God toward the very end of the tribulation period. The rapture has already occurred. The Antichrist is getting ready to attack Israel in the Negev. And the winepress was trodden without the city. Now, that's very important. All of a sudden, out of the middle of nowhere, with no precedent before it, or no precedent after it, we suddenly are introduced to the city. Okay, that's great. And I'll tell you why it's great. If I were to go to Imogene and say, let's go to the city, she'd know I wasn't talking about Dardanelle. She'd know I was talking about Little Rock. And if I were to say, let's go to the great city, she'd know I was talking about Little Rock. Now, this was even more true in Israel. The city in Israel, that's what everybody called it. They either called it the city or they called it the great city. So any time in Scripture, whether it's Old Testament or New Testament, if you look above it, go back maybe a chapter or two, go a chapter or two after it, And if you don't find that city identified specifically as Rome or Bethlehem or Rimmon, then I can tell you this without hesitation. It is Jerusalem. So what does John see? He sees an angel with a great sickle, given authority by an angel that has power over fire, to put it in the earth. We know it goes in a place outside the city. We know it's a great rectangular trough in the earth. Now, all of a sudden, something comes up out of the wine press. Now, when I grew up as a boy, every missionary Baptist preacher that I knew, and every preacher that I know of any stripe or type, always taught that this was human blood, and it was blood of all the people in the Battle of Armageddon. And I just figured that was the case. So when I was a boy, if you had asked me, is that human blood? I would have said yes. If you had asked me, well, is that the blood shed in the Battle of Armageddon? I would have said yes. But I would have said that because that was what I was taught, and because man had not run to and fro and knowledge had not been increased. And because I did not know all this business I've just shown you about a Hebrew wine press and about that having to be the city of Jerusalem. But that is not human blood. And I can tell you this without going into all the proofs I went through last time. This came out of. Ek came out of. And came out of is the Hebrew word ek. Just one little simple word. And it's very specific, and it means exactly what it says, that this blood came up out of the wine press. Now, if this were the armies of the Antichrist, and these were all the people being killed there, then the blood would not come up out of the wine press, this great rectangular trough in the rock of the earth. It would go down into the wine press. So this is not human blood. The wine press is a rectangular trough in the rock of the earth, and this liquid comes up out of it. And what John saw in the earth was a 185 mile or 1600 furlong wine press. When this thing rips open, the part that's going to rip open is from right here to right here. From right here to right here. It's exactly 1,600 furlongs. Now, I'm going to tell you a story that I can't prove, but it's true. When I first looked at this geological structure that you see here, right here, I looked at that and I said, well, if that valley does rip, it'll start ripping here. Notice how it is diffluent. It spreads apart as you go up to here. But then it comes back together, and it's narrow right here. I said, if that thing rips, tears, it will tear to right here, right there. Now, from here to here. Now, I'll give you my word on this, and I have to answer the Lord at the judgment seat. But I had no idea how long that was. I had to go get a map that had a scale on it in miles, and I had to measure from right here to right here to right here. And I was the most dumbfounded man you've ever seen, and the happiest man you've ever seen. It is exactly 1,600 furlongs. And the Bible says that this thing will tear open for a depth of 1,600 furlongs, 1,600 furlongs. And what happens is the blood of the earth comes up on the earth. Now, to me, this is one of the most remarkable prophecies in the Bible. I haven't used any sleight of hand, but do you know there are still missionary Baptist preachers that think I'm crazy? But I promise you, I'm not crazy, because I followed the scripture perfectly. And the word blood is the Greek word hamar, hamati. And hamar or hamati can mean animal blood, bird blood, human blood, the blood that's in grapes, the red liquid in grapes, or it can mean the blood of the earth, which is the magma underneath the earth. But John saw this thing rip open from right here to right here, and the liquid blood came up out on both sides,
and created what geologists call a raging plus basalt plain. We know the sickle goes in outside the city of Jerusalem, and the city of Jerusalem is right back here, this green dot. And this great rectangular trough in the rock of the earth was filled with a blood-red substance. Now bear in mind, John had to report it in terms that he wanted people to know what he was reporting. There is nothing else, absolutely nothing else, that I have ever found in the Hebrew culture that could have been used to describe the Jordan Valley ripped open and looking like that, except it can only be a wine press out in a vineyard. John looked down and he recognized the city of Jerusalem. He saw the sickle go in outside the city. And when he looked into this valley, it was the Jordan River Valley, but it was filled with a depth of blood, red material, up to the horse bridles. Now, were there horses there? Well, if you say, well, the Bible says they were there, it's possible. Maybe some of the Antichrist army is riding on horses, but I really don't think that's the case. You see, in the Hebrew culture, they were a bartering society. And money didn't mean a whole lot to them, although they did use coins when Jesus was here. They bartered and traded. So if somebody had needed a lamb for a sacrifice, then they'd ask somebody for trade. And maybe they'd trade grain stacked up to the horse bridles for a sacrificial lamb. And so it was a standard unit of Hebrew measurement. They used horses. You say, well, some horses don't stand quite the same as other horses. I know, that's why the guy would bring a tall horse when he was going to make any trading if he was on that end of it. But I do know that is a rectangular trough in the rock of the earth. I do believe it is the Jordan River Valley. And I do believe that is going to destroy the Antichrist army. So when you talk about this Hamate coming up out of the wine press, the rectangular trough in the rock of the earth, it's coming up from here to here on both sides of the valley, and it's going to fill it up to a depth of 5 feet. There's only one offshoot fissure that comes off this. It goes from Haifa to Megiddo down to this place where it stops splitting. This is a triple split through here. That's why it will stop right there. This is not going to be a flood basalt plain, but you're going to have a lot of volcanic eruptions in there. And you're already having an increase in earthquake activity along it. But the volcanic valley filled with a blood-red substance will be from here down to here. Now, how is the Antichrist army going to be destroyed? The mountain blows its top. St. Helens would explode with the fury of a 10-megaton bomb. Hot volcanic gases and steam rocketed out horizontally through the fractured mountain. There was very little magma. Came up, very little lava that came out of this volcano. But what this is a heat cloud. It's streams of superheated gas moved down the horseshoe-shaped valley. The temperature there wasn't all that hot. I think it was something like about 600 degrees Celsius. It would have killed you if you'd have been in it. But this thing in the Jordan River Valley is going to be a whole lot worse. This is the little small fishing village of Saint Pierre. This is the way it looked in 1901. It looked like this. And in 1901, you have just over 30,000 people, or right about 30,000 people, living in this coastal city in Saint Pierre, down in the greater Antilles, down in between, off the coast of South America. And back then, they had wooden boats. And they did a lot of trade out of this area. And they had an old volcano sitting back here that had a plug in it. It was a plug that had been created from a previous eruption that hadn't erupted in years. All of a sudden, wham, that plug blew out. I'm going to show you what happened in minutes. In minutes, it went from this to this. In minutes, there was what they call a heat cloud, a heat burst. Not lava, not magma, but a hot flash of heat shot all the way down through here, traveling very quickly. It came across here. It burned, completely disintegrated human flesh, completely disintegrated wood. The only thing it didn't disintegrate were stone structures, cement walls, stone walls. It caused them to crumble and crack and break. It didn't burn them, but it completely disintegrated all the wood, disintegrated all the flesh, and did it in a matter of just a few minutes. Now, this is what it looked like when it came back in. That's a human skull. That's a femur down here. You see some ribs. Now, don't get the idea that's clothing on it. This is soot and ash that settled on it afterwards. But within seconds, when that heat flash hit this individual, and that's not hair either, that's soot, and it just completely burned all the flesh off in seconds. So this is something that a lot of people, I suppose, might equate or relate to the atomic bomb. But now right here is all there was. It came down this valley. Up here on top of this mountain, it came down the valley, didn't touch the mountain, came roaring down through here. This is a steel pole here. You don't see any wood or anything there, nothing but stone. This is a heat flash, and when they come in, there's nothing quite like them. Remember those ships in port? Every ship in port was completely disintegrated. It burned to a crisp on water. This one was about 2 miles out, and the heat flash came across the water, and it killed all the people on board, but the ship somehow stayed afloat. When that came down that hill, there had never been anything like it. It was a heat flash. No lava, no magma, just a huge cloud that came down the mountain. This is the only thing we have, the only picture we have of it. It was taken way out at sea, and it came roaring down, this heat flash cloud, and completely disintegrated the valley. It came from from LA all the way down over St. Pierre, destroyed everything. They call it an avalanche cloud. It's a cloud. The speed of the avalanche was quoted as being 150 kilometers per hour. It killed an estimated 30,000 persons, including the governor. The blast from the volcano consisted of a cloud of superheated steam, a black rolling cloud that moved as though shot from a cannon. The temperature was 650 to 700 degrees centigrade. The entire town was ignited as if by a giant match. We're talking about an hour of it burning. It disintegrated everything. How Pelé killed St. Pierre, sudden and destructive. A few days later, on the morning of May 8th, a huge crack burst open in Pelé's flank. Out of it tore an incandescent cloud of steam, other gases, and dust, which in less than a minute engulfed St. Pierre, reducing it to a ruin. There, terribly burned but still living, was a young Negro named Ludger Silberis. He had survived the Holocaust because his cell was fitted with only a tiny crate window, which had kept out the full force of Pelé's crowd. It was down in the cellar. Silberis said that he had heard no noise, no sound, and seen no fire, and that the exceeding heat had lasted only a moment. That terrible moment, however, had been sufficient to kill 30,000 people, every one of the citizens of St. Pierre, except Ludger Silberis. And he himself was in a cellar in the jail, and it couldn't get in at him. Now in Daniel 12:1, we're told what's going to happen to the Antichrist. And it will happen. And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation even to that time, and at that time my people shall be delivered, every one that she faced shall be found written in the book. The last chapter in Daniel 11:45, the last verse in it, just before this, and this is continuous, and at that time refers to the time when the Antichrist is in a position where no one can help him. Matthew 24:21-29 echoes this, and 29 and 30. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh. This is talking about the remnant that goes through the tribulation period that survives. And if God hadn't shortened these days, there wouldn't be any human flesh left. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. That's the 1/3 of Israel that goes into the remnant, as written in Zechariah chapter 13, the last two verses, 8 and 9. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn when they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Nobody's ready for this. Israel's certainly not ready for it. And when this happens, there won't even be any news networks left up in the United States to be broadcasting. Maybe it's a good thing. Maybe the horror of the reporting of it would make it even worse than it really is. But God made this valley. This is from Hebrew University in Jerusalem. I didn't make this chart. You can see here it's the Gulf of Elot. It goes north right up to here. God put it there. He also put the fault line down where the Battle of Armageddon is supposed to be fought. At the plain of Es Elon, the plain of Jezreel, the Tell of Megiddo. Armageddon is right here. When God rips that open, you're going to have some flesh left. But the flesh is going to be left on these mountains back here. There won't be any flesh left in here. It'll all be burned off completely. There will not be any flesh left anywhere close to that valley. But there'll be some flesh back on the mountain. And these Hebrew eagles, as they're called in the Bible, but they're actually vultures, they're going to have plenty of flesh to eat. They'll pick the bones on the mountains of Israel, because a lot of the Antichrist army will be actually killed by earthquakes outside the valley, back on the hills of Judea. The fiery consumption of Antichrist army. And he gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. Revelation 16:16. Ezekiel 39:2, Revelation 14:20, Malachi 4:1. And I will turn thee back and leave but the sixth part of thee, and will cause thee to come up from the north part and bring thee upon the mountains of Israel. And the winepress, Lanos, was trodden without the city, Jerusalem. And blood came out of the winepress, even to the horse bridles by the space of 1,600 furlongs. When you take a look at this, it's quite a ways over to the side of the Jordan Valley. These are the Judean hills over here. These are the hills of Moab. When this suddenly comes up, it comes up at anywhere from 800 to 1200 degrees Celsius. When it comes up, the heat flash suddenly comes out and goes up against these mountains. It won't go into the mountains. It'll just affect everything in the valley. And the Antichrist army won't have to be in this liquid rock. Some of them will be. But those standing back here will have the flesh burned off their bones instantly before they realize anything else could possibly have happened to them. There'll be plenty of buzzard bait left on the mountains, but quite frankly, if you take a look at this, he tells you in Malachi 4:1, "For behold, the day cometh that shall burn us in oven, and all the proud, yea, and all that do wickedly shall be stubble. The day that cometh shall burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts. This shall leave them neither root nor branch." This is a cremation process. Secondary chamber is 1,600 degrees Fahrenheit. This magma is in excess of 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. In a magma chamber, it's 1,100 to 1,400 degrees Fahrenheit. The heat flash from this magma is up around 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. This is the way they cremate a body. It doesn't take long. And a heat flash from on the sides of that magma all the way over to the Moab Mountain, the mountains of Ammon further north, the Judean hills, the Samarian hills further north, where the Antichrist army is going to be headed, they're going to get cremated. No charge. God's going to do it for free. And this shall be the plague. The word plague is Megiphah. It means the slaughter. Wherein the Lord will smite the people that have fought against Jerusalem. This is where it occurs, outside the city of Jerusalem. Their flesh shall consume away. The word is Makok. It means milk. Shall melt away while they stand upon their feet. That's not from a nuclear bomb. That's from God's heat flash. And their eyes shall consume, the word Makok, melt away in their holes, the socket. And their tongue shall consume, Makok, melt away in their mouth. Zechariah 14:12. When the land is lifted from Geba to Rimmon, and when the Mount of Olives is split, and it's 2 minutes after, and I only got one sheet left, and I covered as much as I wanted to, so I won't let you all go early. You know, I'm the one that presents this. But you know, what really, what really has caused me to stay faithful is that I'm the one that had to research all this. And sometimes in the military, we had to fudge around and do things that, I don't get to call it dishonest, but you know, we do things to make ourselves look good on some report that wasn't particularly, would stretch it a lot. I didn't have to stretch anything on this. It all fell into place. Every word that I looked up, every geological feature that I found, I didn't have to fudge it or push it or twist it. It just all fell into place. Every time I start to get discouraged or something happens where I lose a loved one or the kids don't do what I want, I've been married now for 49 years. Imogen's not out here now. Do you know, I'd have to say in all these years, she has never displeased me. She has never, in all those years, displeased me. In everything that's ever happened in our marriage, I was always the guilty part. So God gave me a good wife. You have no idea. Well, you do. You men know the value of a good wife, and I've got a good one. Kids don't always do what the parents want. I'd like for them all to go to church 3 times a week, not to be worldly in any way. I'd like them to be goody-two-shoes, and to work on that. But you know, it's not easy to stay in the faith and preach and teach the word without seeing a lot of results. And I guess staying here for 30 years was beneficial for me, because these results here have been very slow. But this is what's kept me in the Word. Man, listen, I don't have any problem worshiping God. He did all that. He's got it all planned. And it's just a real joy to serve Him. So anytime I get discouraged, I just remind myself of that. And I'm telling you that because that's what you need to do. That's what we all need to do. We're going to enter into some pretty discouraging times. We're going to lose loved ones. We're going to have things happen that make us very sad. Parents all have to die sooner or later. And I hated to give up mine. I doubt if there's anybody here that was anxious to give up their parents. And children die. Brothers and sisters die. But you've always got someone who never dies. And that's who I'm talking about in doing all this. What a masterful plan. What a marvelous, wonderful plan. And I'm very grateful to God that He let me understand it. Brother Ken Eubanks, would you dismiss us?